This is the premier broadcast of JewishRacism.com radio. It is Wednesday, May 23rd, 2007. My name is Christopher John Bjerknes. I am fortunate to have as my first guest Jim Condit Jr. I encountered Jim on Daryl Bradford Smith's radio program, The French Connection, at IamTheWitness.com. Jim produced an amazing DVD in 2003 entitled The Final Solution to Adolf Hitler. Please allow me to introduce my guest, Jim Condit Jr. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Christopher. Thanks for having us on.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you for coming on.
Sure.
Would you please let my listeners know a little bit about yourself and about your DVD, The Final Solution to Adolf Hitler, and where they can get a copy of it?
Sure. Well, I've been around in the world of looking at public affairs and politics in the United States since about 1972, at the age of 19, right before the Supreme Court legalized abortion, and I got involved in the pro-life movement, and then we ran a city council slate in 1979 because we realized both the Republican and Democratic parties were basically the same party then. We ran an independent slate in Cincinnati City Council race, and we didn't know who was controlling both parties at that point. We just noticed they seemed to be kind of big-time wrestling. They act like they disagree on small things, but then they really are following the same agenda. And something happened in the 1979 race, without going into it too much length, that confirmed something we had been told about, which was the scam of computerized vote fraud. Okay, so in 1981, we got involved in that issue, 19 years before it hit the national consciousness. And then in 1990, I started publishing a small magazine and newspaper eventually. We didn't publish that many issues. We published 7 issues in the 90s and published the last 4 in 1998. And because of that paper, I got a call from someone who said, basically said, I got something for you. I don't know how many people would be willing to put this out, but maybe you could give this, what my research, some play. And I refer to this person in the DVD as Ratisbon at his request. And so he said, I have nothing but the gold for you here. And he started to tell me in 1999 that Nazism had basically been largely a Jewish-controlled movement. And I was listening to him. At first I thought, wow, I think he may have something here, but he's going too far, you know. He even said that when all the research on this is out, that we will probably find that almost every top National Socialist leader in Germany, including Hitler, was part Jewish. And at that point I was thinking, oh, I think he's really going overboard here. But I listened to him, and he did have a ton of good points, and I eventually came around to thinking where he was really close to being on the track, if not right on the track. And so then eventually we did an article in the last issue of the paper we ever put out. And then eventually I kept talking back and forth to the fellow, and I started doing a little research myself, although 80 to 90% of it is his. And we started to find more and more stuff, and his comment was, once you have the Rosetta Stone on this subject, then all kinds of stuff starts pouring out. So that we finally, in 2002, I believe, filmed, just to put it on tape. A friend of mine had a professional camera. He was passing through town, and he said, why don't we set this up and do it? So we filmed the Final Solution to Adolf Hitler DVD, which people can read. A lot of free information is at HitlerDVD.com, and people can read about it there. Even if they don't want to purchase the video, they can look at a lot of free information, and we'll give out as much as we can on this show as well. And the basic thesis, though, was that Nazism, like communism, was another operation of the Jewish bankers. And the whole world was put in a tremendous vice here, and we're leading up to World War II, for the purpose of advancing the agenda of world government under Zionism. I usually call the hierarchy Judeo-Masonry, meaning the top Zionist Jews and the Freemasons like the Bushes and the Rockefellers and so forth, or, you know, the people dispute on what some of these folks are, but that there was kind of a collaboration, it seems, between English Freemasonry, Anglo Freemasonry, and the top Jewish bankers to move forward this world agenda.
Let me interrupt you there.
Go ahead.
Now, how would you define Zionism from the Nazi perspective, and why is it that Jews would instigate the Nazi Party in order to persecute other Jews? What was their motivation in establishing the Nazi Party to persecute Jews?
Yeah, and that's the question. And leading into answering that, I like to tell people that this research, actually, when you come out the other end, and the answer turns out to be that the everyday people on all sides were victimized by this World War II, and the everyday Jewish people, the everyday German people, the everyday Polish people, they were all caught in a vice between four super criminals that were funded by the Rothschild bankers, the Jewish Zionist Rothschild bankers behind the scenes. The four super criminals were Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States, Stalin in the USSR, and Hitler in Germany. All of them funded, and really a lot of the brains of the whole movement coming in from that one faction. Now, the reason is this. There was a lot of assimilation going on in Germany and in Europe and in other places, at least economically and socially, where Jews were becoming comfortable in Europe, you know. And
Jews were intermarrying with non-Jews. Jews were...
Yes.
People may not realize this, but 100 years earlier, Jews were still living in ghettos. They had not yet been emancipated. They
yes.
suddenly had all full rights. They were in the German military. They were able to enter professorships, able to work in the civil service.
Yes.
And they were becoming less aligned specifically with the Jewish community, as they were forced to do and as they chose to do in the ghetto system.
Yes.
And the Jewish bankers and Zionist Jews were very concerned that the so-called Jewish race was disappearing through assimilation. They believed that the Jewish people would become extinct through the process of assimilation, and that terrified them.
Yes, and also, I would not be able to talk on this at the moment, but my mentor on this says that the ghetto system was always desired by the rabbis throughout history and by the top leaders of the Jewish community. They always wanted that separateness, and they would even provoke persecutions at times in order to convince the Jewish people that they had to stay under their close control or whatever. So now, the other thing that's happening is that there was this move to get a Jewish state founded in Palestine, okay? So the Zionists had been getting no traction whatsoever in Germany. There was all kinds of papers that were run by different Jewish groups. The Zionists were one of them. They were getting zero traction. I use this analogy. It's like if people came to you or me and said, now we have this project in it right now. They came to any one of us listening to this or participating. They came and said, we have this project right now in Antarctica. And would you like to go down there? And it's, you know, it could be a really good thing and blah, 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 blah. And we would say, well, I don't know. You know, I live here in the United States or in Australia or wherever. My family's here. I really don't think I want to go. Then a few years later, us and our families are forcibly rounded up, put into concentration camps. And then the same people come back to us, and a few of our family members are killed through work and low calorie content, starvation and disease in the concentration camps. And then they come back to us and say, now would you like to go down to Antarctica? And we might say, well, now maybe I can make room on my schedule because you want to get out of the concentration camp. That's basically, in a simplistic way, what happened to the everyday Jews in Europe. There's a book, one of the sources we cite in the DVD is the book by Rabbi Moshe Schoenfeld, which is called Victims Accuse, and it is about the Orthodox Jews primarily accusing the Jewish police in Germany of working with Hitler and rounding up the everyday Jews, especially the Orthodox Jews, and putting in helping to turn them over to Hitler. So that book is still available online from the group of anti-Zionist Jews that is in New York City, I believe.
But there was a much broader program of Zionist collaboration directly with the Nazis to transfer in the Ha'avara Agreement Jews from Germany to Palestine. And there again, they met resistance in that many of the Jews who went to Palestine returned to Germany. They preferred to live in Nazi Germany to Palestine.
Yes, and so the point, so picking up on that other analogy, the Rothschild faction was basically saying to the everyday Jews in Germany and Europe, why don't you leave this civilized country where you have a pretty nice life or a nice life and go down to the sands, the hot sands of Arabia, and fight the Arabs for the rest of your life? That basically was the choice that they were being given, and they didn't want to do it.
And the Rothschilds had set everything up through the First World War and through the destruction of the Turkish Empire to enable themselves to establish a Jewish state in Palestine. And the only resistance they really met was from the Jewish community itself. The Jewish community itself strongly resisted Zionism, which was mostly popular among Eastern European Jews who lived in impoverished conditions in shtetls. And they essentially had to bribe those Jews, and they mostly got
small things, but then they...
And those ne'er-do-wells angered the local Arabs, and that also served as an obstacle to Zionism.
Yes, yes. Now, let's get back to the transfer agreement or the Havre agreement in just a second. But let's realize what happened when Hitler came to power in March of 1933. Now, let's go back to the fact that Hitler, and we'll come back to this too, Hitler in his earlier career actually worked for the communists in Munich, that took over Munich in 1919 for about 6 months. This is mentioned in the book, I think, Hitler, by Ian Kershaw of, I believe, Oxford University. And that book came out in 1999.
It's very important to point out that Hitler later presented himself as the arch anti-communist in the world. And that is one of the reasons that is given why the English didn't more strongly oppose Hitler, is because they wanted a buffer against Bolshevism from the east spreading westward across Europe. But it's coming out that Hitler was in fact himself a communist and was orchestrating a controlled opposition to communism so that both forces were working together to spread communism across Eastern Europe.
Yes, yes. And in 1919, before he went into the Nazi Party, he was actually the go-between between the head communist honchos in Munich. The communists had taken over a number of cities in Europe for about 6 months after World War One, because they were expecting the Red Army to arrive and conquer all of Europe. In fact, the Red Army in 1922, it's now escaping me, but at some point they were stopped at the Vistula River in Poland by the Polish, which is a story in itself. So even in I doubted that thing I just told you when I first heard it. So I went to the Encyclopedia Britannica, which has always been a Jewish-controlled publication, and they say in the Encyclopedia Britannica 1989 edition, which my family has, they say that the defeat by the Poles at the Vistula River ended the hope of the communists to take over Europe in that generation. But
now, why is it that the Poles and the Germans were so very concerned that Bolshevism not spread westward?
Well, I mean, for one thing, I assume they were aware of all the bloody massacres that happened once the communists took over in 1917, 1918 in Russia.
So there was a widespread terror around the world that if Bolshevism were to spread, it would result in millions and tens of millions of deaths.
Yes, and of course the modus operandi of communism, which was always one of Talmudic Judaism's main arms. It's communism is Jewish. It's period. It's Talmudic Jewish. That one of their modus operandi is to kill off the intelligentsia in every country they try to take over.
And you'll also note that in Nazism, they basically subverted the education system. Even though the myth is that the Nazis promoted the fulfillment of the German people and the encouragement of the intellectual class of Germany, they really subverted the entire educational system and tried to establish a classless society along the lines of communism. And they were also revolutionaries. They overtly stated that Nazism was a world revolution.
Yes. And another thing, National Socialism, communism is international socialism. My friend, my mentor in his subject, said, we used to think that all socialism was Jewish except Nazism. Now we know that all socialism is Jewish.
By that you mean in the 20th century?
In the 20th century, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, but even you think that some points in before that, that some of socialism was not Jewish inspired?
I think in the early French movements of socialism, it was not not as heavily Jewish as it became in the 20th century.
That very well may be true. Although I would think that if we traced it back, the intellectual motivators of socialism were probably always Jewish. Although, you know, I stand correction on that, but I would kind of suspect that that's the case. But certainly in the 20th century now, we see that Nazism is again riddled with Jewish influence. So, but the reason I just wanted to go briefly into Hitler's rise there, because his being the go-between between the head honchos and the barracks to explain the communist program for 6 months. This is mentioned in a book called The Prisoner of Ottawa by Douglas Reed. He was interviewing Otto Strasser, who was one of the competitors of Hitler to be head of the Nazi Party, and he was banned to Canada, and even after World War II, they never let him back into Germany. And in that book in 1953, Strasser says at some point to the author Reed, he says, there's three things that need to be looked into about Adolf Hitler. One is his murky origins, namely, what is his real ancestry? Two is what happened to him after World War II, because then it was doctrine that nothing was found of Hitler's body, that there was not a trace found of Hitler's body, even though now since 1989 they've been trying to throw doubt on that with the alleged revelations of the Soviet archives that were opened up. And the third thing he said is, what was Hitler doing in Munich in 1919 when the communists took over? He said in the 20s, when Hitler was on the rise in the Nazi movement, that some of the rank-and-file Nazis would be drinking beers or whatever after a meeting, and somebody would say, what was Adolf doing in Munich in 1919, meaning with the communists in 1919? So people would generally just, you know, say one or two things and then just shrug their shoulders and move on.
Many people may not realize, but after World War I, Germany was in a very weakened condition, and the communists were able to take over Bavaria and form it into a Soviet republic. And
yes,
Adolf Hitler is captured on film marching in the funeral procession of Kurt Eisner, who was one of the Jewish leaders of the Spartacus movement to take over Bavaria and form it into a Soviet republic. And he was deposed by the Freikorps, who were monarchists and wanted to reestablish Kaiser Wilhelm as leader of Germany. And they were surprised that Hitler would suddenly appear and start screaming out loudly against the communists when they knew that during the communist revolt in Bavaria, he had supported the communists. And
yes,
you mentioned, what was precisely his role when working with the communists?
According to Ian Kershaw and Hitler, in his biography of Hitler came out in 1999, Hitler, and this is the only place I saw this mentioned, but Kershaw said that Hitler was the go-between between the leaders of the communist movement there and the soldiers in the barracks. In other words, he would go to the soldiers to kind of help them up on the ideology and the goodness of what they were doing. You see.
So even then, he was a propagandist.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that Kershaw, who's supposed to be one of the great world historians, he says this period is unexplainable in light of the rest of Adolf Hitler's career. To which I say, no, it isn't. It's just we're kind of jumping ahead a little here because there's so many things that need to be brought together. The deception is so great. To me, it's just a one-fourth and more likely a half-Jewish man who's ambitious, looking for where is his star, where is his place in the New World Order. And he was going with the communists. When that failed, then he decided to go in another direction.
Well, so, let's paint a picture following World War I of the world perspective from the point of view of the Jewish bankers. They had destroyed the German Empire. They had conducted a revolution in Russia, which emancipated all the Jews of Russia, who were then free to leave to go to Palestine if they so chose. They had the funds to purchase Palestine. They had the funds to move all the Jews to Palestine. They had the British mandate controlling Palestine, and they had the League of Nations, which they created for the very purpose to establish all the legal framework to establish a state within Palestine. Now,
yes,
what was missing from their plan, and why would they turn to Hitler to persecute the Jews?
And as you said before, that what was missing was the Jews who were living, the everyday Jewish people who were living and making a living and really making a nice life in Europe, did not want to be uprooted and go down to the sands of Arabia in the scorching heat to fight the Arabs for the rest of their lives. That's what they did not want to do. So what Hitler did, as we get through the skip through the 20s for a minute, in according to and I think this is important to so people understand this, according to Otto Strasser, who one of Hitler's rivals, who's the subject of The Prisoner of Ottawa, he said, "We looked up one day and we found out that we were overwhelmed by the money that Hitler suddenly had."
Now, what precisely chronological period are you talking about?
We're talking about 1929.
Hitler was suddenly flooded with money.
Yes. Now, and a few other sources that talk about this are, one, the Rakovsky interrogation, which some people might doubt, but many people do not doubt it because it fits many things said in there, explain things that are very hard to know about World War II. Rakovsky, in that, who was a high-level communist Trotskyite who was arrested for the Stalin show trials of 1938, he said that the Warburg banking establishment was used to get Hitler what was about the equivalent of $100 million in today's money in 1929.
Now, it's important to point out that the Warburgs were Jewish bankers who were involved both in America and in Germany. Paul Warburg was the Jewish banker who worked with Nelson Aldrich to establish the Federal Reserve Act on Jekyll Island.
Yes, in about 1912, 1913, right?
And then you had Max Warburg, who financed Trotsky and the Russian Revolution. And all of these were Jewish bankers who were working underneath the umbrella of the Rothschild fortunes.
Yes. Now, according to Eustace Mullins, who's been a kind of an acclaimed historian, independent historian over the last 50 years, he claims that the Warburgs were the leading banking family in Germany before Hitler, during Hitler, and after Hitler. Now, if that, I don't have anything other than hearing him say that on an interview with Daryl Bradford Smith, but if that be true, then that's another nail in the coffin of the traditional histories about Hitler, because while he's rounding up all these everyday Jews, he doesn't arrest the head Jewish bankers. He doesn't shut them down.
Well, one thing that's amazing is that both Eustace Mullins on Daryl Bradford Smith's program and Douglas Reed in one of his works stated that the Jewish bankers marched with Hitler in his parade carrying a sign that said, "Throw us out."
Well, and this is brings up another point regarding, I lost my train of thought, but let me go into several other sources on that Hitler got this money. There's another book out called Who Financed Hitler by James and Suzanne Poole, P-O-O-L-E, and if you can get the original copy, get the original copy on the used books, because 100 pages disappeared when it was republished years later. But one of the things Poole says in there is that, yes, Hitler did get many, many small donations from businessmen after he got going, okay? And this, I believe that the rise of Hitler was not something done against the bankers. It was done as part of the plan to set Germany up for permanent enslavement, which happened during World War II. In other words, they were humiliated at Versailles by being sold out by all the leaders that were there, and then so then they're living in total abject poverty, and, you know, we've all heard the stories of the wheelbarrows. Husbands were taking wheelbarrows
of
money. Yes,
let's get into the conditions that Germany faced after the First World War when in the Weimar Republic. And
now, could I ask you a question that you may know better than me? Is it true that the Germans were actually winning? I've heard the Germans were actually going to win World War One.
Yes, they were winning the war in 1916, and the Zionists who had been centered in Berlin went to the Kaiser and said, "Will you give us Palestine?" And the Kaiser was in a bind because Palestine was controlled by the Turkish Empire, and Germany was allied with the Turks against the Allies.
Mm-hmm.
And he essentially said, yes, he would give them Palestine as a place for a homeland, but no, he could not make it an autonomous, completely independent state outside of the Turkish Empire. Then the Zionists went to the British and offered the British a deal, and they said, your survival is threatened. If you want to survive, make a deal with us that if we bring America into the war to help you defeat the Germans and the Turks, that you will then give us Palestine as a homeland for the Jews.
And this is the Balfour Declaration.
This is the Balfour Declaration, which was written and sent directly to Lord Rothschild.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was 19. Was that 19?
That was 1917 when the Balfour Declaration was issued, and that is right when America entered the war, and that is also when the Russian Revolution took place.
Yes, yes. And that's very critical. So, and on the Battle of the Somme, S-O-M-M-E, as I remember it, if I got my history right, the Germans had come up with the machine guns, and as the British climbed over the cliff or whatever and kind of entered a plain, tens of thousands, if I got, you correct me if you know this better than I do, but tens of thousands or maybe even more British soldiers were cut down by these machine guns, which were just ripping bullets through them right and left. So there was, in other words, they were not going to win, and Germany was going to win the war at the rate things were going.
Not only would Germany win the war, but Germany was proposing peace terms to end the war that would return the situation of Europe to its status quo before the war. And and that absolutely the Jewish bankers did not want.
No, they
wanted all the empires to be broken up so that all the small ethnicities could petition in the League of Nations for the formation of segregated states based on ethnicity, which would give Jews the option to petition for a segregated Jewish state in Palestine. And that was the ultimate goal of the peace conferences. So they were very much opposed to the peace initiatives of the Germans.
And not only, just to fill in a side piece, not only was the Tsar of Russia knocked off his throne, the Romanovs, after 500 years of rule in Russia, but all the Catholic monarchs, such as the Habsburgs, were effectively dislodged also during World War I, so that they no longer existed either, basically, when the war was over. So then the Versailles Treaty, though, the terms imposed on Germany were so ridiculous that people looking at them afterwards said, these couldn't mathematically come true no matter what you did. It was very harsh terms. And then I remember hearing in grade school and high school that right before Hitler, I guess, started to rise to power in the late 20s or whatever, that the inflation was so bad that men were being paid at three times a day, running the money to the gate to their wives, who would then go and try to buy the bread or whatever. This is how bad that we heard the inflation was in the 60s.
And this gave the Jewish bankers the opportunity to pilfer the wealth of Germany. They were able to buy up everything at very reduced prices.
Yes, that's another thing that caused
this caused great resentment against the Jews, both because the Jews knew that the German Christians knew that Zionist Jews had betrayed Germany during the war. It was Jews who initially had beat the war drums for war in Germany, and then at the end of the war, leading Jews in the press and in politics stabbed Germany in the back and demanded that Germany pay reparations and give up lands and blame Germany for the war. And this was a grave affront to the German people, because the Zionist agent of the Jews in America, Woodrow Wilson, had issued the 14 points, which promised Germany an equitable peace. And Germany would not have surrendered, and there never would have been a Treaty of Versailles, had it not been for Wilson's pledges, which the Zionist Jews who controlled the Treaty of Versailles reneged upon.
Yes. Now, there's a million side streets to go in, but it is also important, and actually, you know, I would say, and I'm glad that you do, I think you know more about this subject than I do, and I'm glad, because I want to learn, we want to all fill in as much information as we can, but I just want to mention how deeply laid this plot was against humanity by these evil Zionist Jewish bankers. People may not know that the Ross-Perot option was used against President Taft in 1912. President Taft is from Cincinnati, where I'm from, and believe me, there are no great prizes, but he was not a subversive, you know. He was the president, and what they did was they funded, through a Jewish guy named Benjamin Friedman, who eventually told the story, they funded Teddy Roosevelt to come out of retirement and run in the absurdly named Bull Moose Party, just so that Roosevelt could split the vote enough so that Wilson, a complete tool of Bernard Baruch and the Jewish bankers, could be elected president, because under Wilson they had to get in the Federal Reserve Board to take control of the United States money. They wanted the income tax in so they could harass and snoop into everybody's finances eventually, and they needed to get us into World War One, and they needed to have a president there who would cooperate in doing that completely. So,
and Wilson ran on the idea that he would keep America out of the war, and it was a complete lie.
Right. And even Roosevelt run on that one time? He kept us out of war or something 20 years later. So at any rate, I say that the money that was made available to Hitler and Germany was part of the plan from the bankers, so that Hitler, the average German who had been living in abject poverty and humiliation, suddenly sees a guy come on the stage who is sticking up for them. And this is what got, and Hitler was a great orator, and he seemed to believe what he was doing. Now, I say this in the tape, and it probably is the most controversial part of the tape in a way, but I'm going to tell you, I'm not saying this is a ironclad rule, but I am telling you, I'm 54 years old. If I would have heard someone say this 35 years ago, I would have thought, what a disgusting, narrow-minded racist. But I'm going to tell you something about people I've met that does not leave me mesmerized by Hitler. I never was. I always felt his rhetoric. I couldn't understand it. It was scary and angry. But I have met several Jewish people in my life. Usually they're half Jewish, part German, part Jewish or something, who, when they go up on the stage, you can say, wow, that person believes in this issue more than any of us does. If we could, there was one lady we had who spoke at a pro-life gathering in 1992, and she did a great job, half Jewish, half German. And I remember one of my friends, when he came out, he said, if we ever take over a country, Jim, we've got to make that lady queen. This is how effective of an orator she was, okay? 2 years later, she's doing a movie with Planned Parenthood, not dissing pro-life, but dissing Christianity through the whole thing. And I've seen several people who are part Jewish, and maybe some other peoples could do this too. They can convince you they believe in your issue much more than you do, but in reality, they don't believe in it at all. And they eventually do things that have people scratching their head and losing their faith in God and humanity and everything else. So just because of the fact that Hitler could go up there and scream and be an effective orator and inspire people does not mean to me anything. I'll tell you what my mentor said about the Nazis, and maybe this is an oversimplification, but he said, think of Charlie Chaplin and a bunch of Jews putting on Nazi uniforms and running up on the stage and starting to scream anti-Semitism.
Well, many people, that's exactly their impression of what Hitler was. He was a Jew spoofing an anti-Semite.
Yeah. So more sources real quickly on this $100 million in equivalent that went to Hitler in 1929. James Poole says that in 1929 through 33, the Nazis had unlimited money for everything they wanted. They had the plane fares. I mean, the planes were operating. All the best of everything, advancement.
They had flags, they had uniforms, they had promotional posters. Germany was suddenly smothered in Nazi propaganda.
Yeah, and this is what happened. I might add, I was working for Pat Buchanan in the 1990, not as a, you know, just as a volunteer. But Clinton and Dole in 1996 had offices everywhere. And Buchanan's could hardly have offices anywhere. Buchanan had no help. He had 140,000 small donors. He had none of this big money. They didn't have headquarters hardly anywhere, except
now,
for maybe in the early primaries. But how did Clinton and them, how do they have headquarters everywhere? And, of course, it's the same principle. The bankers give unlimited help to the people that they want to progress.
That's what I would like to ask you about. What was Hitler's situation before all this money flooded in? Was he popular with the German people? Could he have won the chancellor's election without that support? In other words, had not the Jewish bankers intervened to finance Hitler, would there have been a Hitler, Adolf Hitler as chancellor of Germany?
Well, you're actually asking me a question I don't have as much information as I should on, but I know that Strasser in that book says that there was a number of people competing for the Nazi Party. It was only after this 1929 that Hitler got the leg up on them. I would imagine, I do know, from what I've heard and studied, he was a great orator, and he was able to move a lot of people with his oratory, but whether he could have been elected on that alone, I don't really know. I don't know that much about, you know, what his circumstances were, other than his faction was a struggling faction before 1929.
That's my understanding, that he had absolutely no chance of pulling off and winning the election had it not been for the sudden influx of money. And I'd like to mention that Otto Strasser and his brother Gregor Strasser were both strong communists.
Before they became Nazis.
As Nazis. It was well known in the press that they were strongly, strongly communist. And Ernst Röhm was another very red Nazi, even redder than Hitler.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a tip-off. And my mentor says that the Strassers were also part Jewish, and I've never been able to verify that from actual sources, though. But much in Strasser's life is puzzling if you try to read him as a Catholic, which Hitler also claimed to be. It's very puzzling if you look at his life from try to explain it. You'd have to say he was like an apostate Catholic from the way he lived his life. But he was an opponent of Hitler. Another book is Hitler's Secret Backers, which is allegedly published by a Sidney Warburg and was pulled off the market shortly after it came out in mid-1930s. And Anthony Sutton, in his book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, which was written, I believe, in the 70s, refers to that book. And, of course, maybe the best evidence of the Jewish bankers helping Hitler is Anthony Sutton's well-documented works, including one of the books that came out of it, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. And Sutton does not really distinguish between Jewish and non-Jewish bankers or financiers, but if you read between the lines and look at the names of and the documentation and the companies that he has, such as IBG Farben, that helped Hitler, then it becomes clear that this was a movement like communism funded from the top. It was not a movement that originated from the grassroots people.
Well, we also have another good source, which was published in the New York Times on 7 August 1933 on page 4, which is the text of Untermeyer's address. Samuel Untermeyer directly accused the Jewish bankers and specifically said Jewish bankers of financing Hitler.
And that's an extremely strong source. I mean, that is like better than some of these others almost, because it's coming right out of one of the top Jewish leaders' mouth.
Which reminds me, what was the situation where World Jewry demanded a boycott of German goods, and how did Germany finance itself when confronted with that boycott?
Good question. Let me answer that, then let's get to the month that Hitler came to power in 1933.
Well, let's start with that.
Please?
Let's start with that. January 19th.
We'll come back to this. Untermeyer's speech, I want to challenge the traditional interpretation of that speech, and then we want to talk about the transfer agreement again, which helped the Nazis were funding the Jews in Palestine trying to gain traction to take over during the Nazi era. But when Hitler came to power in March of 1933, which was the same month that Franklin Roosevelt took the oath of office, because back then the president took the oath on March 20th, I think, instead of January 20th, that month several things began to happen. One is Hitler started screaming, bloody anti-Semitism, bloody anti-Semitism, we got to do something against. And of course he had certain little things he could appeal to that the average German would say, yeah, they did just buy up all of our stuff for pennies on the dollar. So there were seeds there laid by the bankers that Hitler could use to be somewhat credible with the people. He was sticking up for them. He suddenly was able to make the economy go, partly through this transfer of money, and then they also issued their own money under Nazism after a while, which is another subject. But one of the things he did was he shut down all, according to the article by Klaus Polkin, Secret Contacts Between Nazis and Zionists, I believe is the name of the article, which was in the Journal for Palestine Studies in 1976. The month escapes me right now. We mentioned the video, and I have the book somewhere within arm reach here, but it's the Journal of Palestine Studies. And he says that Hitler shut down every Jewish paper in Nazi Germany except for the Zionist paper, and he jailed some of the editors, because there were a number of patriotic Jewish soldier types who fought with the Germans in World War One, who were publishing just Jewish journals, Jewish news, not necessarily any particular agenda. These were by far the more popular papers. According to this article, Hitler shut down all of the Jewish-run papers except for the Zionists. And because he was simultaneously threatening the everyday Jewish population, the Zionist paper then began to gain traction.
We should also mention that the Nuremberg laws encouraged Zionism. They allowed the Zionists to fly Zionist flags and to wear Zionist uniforms, and any other Jewish displays were forbidden.
That's critical too, and fits into the same exact pattern. And then also, we learned from the book IBM and the Holocaust, which came out around 1998-99, I believe. IBM and the Holocaust was written by the same guy that wrote the transfer agreement, Edwin Black, a Jewish author. And the IBM and the Holocaust reveals that IBM, Thomas Watson from New York City, where IBM was headquartered, landed in Nazi Germany the same month Hitler came to power and began to help Hitler catalog all the Jews in Germany by the use of IBM punch cards, which were used for voting in Cincinnati up till like 2 years ago. But they were using them back then to catalog all the Jews they could find in Germany.
Now, people are going to think that they were cataloging the Jews because there was a plan to exterminate the Jews. Do you believe that there was any such plan at that time to exterminate the Jews, and why do you think they were cataloging the Jews?
Well, I asked the question in my video, do you think that the everyday Germans were demanding that the Jews be cataloged? Any everyday German that you can get to find to talk about that era who was there will say they didn't, you know, they were kind of like Americans who look up one day and say, somebody says we're sending 250,000 troops to Iraq or whatever. They're just watching things happen. The German people were in no way demanding any cataloging of the Jews. It was the top Jewish bankers who were demanding it. And the proof that they were cataloging them to get them out of the country is what happened in the initial years of the Hitler regime. In that same article by Klaus Polkin, Secret Nazi Jewish Contacts, 1933 to 1941, I think is the title of the article, in 1976, again, Journal of Palestine Studies, he says that there were, the first time the Jews headed for Palestine in 1935, I think, on a ship, there was a Nazi commander on the ship, and the ship was flying both the Star of David and the Nazi flag on the same ship.
And it was publicized in Goebbels' journal, I think, Der Angriff. It was called Ein Nazi Fährt nach Palästina, and it was highly publicized in Germany in an SS publication.
Yes.
The fact that the SS was arranging for the Jews to be moved to Palestine. Now, isn't that a very strange thing for supposedly anti-Semitic Nazis to promote?
Yes, because if you were truly anti-Semitic, you would not want to cooperate with the Zionists to plot themselves in the most holy religious area of the world, according to the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews, and give them the propaganda boost that has given Zionist Judaism to have actually taken over that territory. So I have always objected to that as being something that proves again that Hitler was not what we were told he was, namely someone who was just rabidly anti-Jewish. Now,
And the Nazis were also promoting Zionist training camps for Jewish youth.
That's correct. And also we have a pamphlet from, which I hold up in the video, from 1938 from the B'nai B'rith. I think it's the B'nai B'rith. It could be the American Jewish Committee, but I think it's the ADL, the B'nai B'rith. And they in there brag about how they had to straighten Mussolini out as to what was going on. And both Mussolini and Adolf Eichmann under Hitler set up training camps for the Irgun. Now, the Irgun was the name of the Jewish strike force. Some would call them the Jewish terrorist group that actually led the way in taking over Palestine and exterminating whole Arab villages in 1948. So
now, why didn't the Jews travel instead of going to Palestine? Why didn't they travel to, say, London or New York City?
Well, let's go into that. I knew a fact back in 1970s. I had known this fact, and kind of strange where the FDR is praised. I had one book where when FDR died, all the eulogies, all the letters of praise, and a lot of them were from Jewish organizations – And when I read these letters from the Jewish organizations about Roosevelt when he died, you would think it was the second coming of the Messiah. Yet on the other hand, you'll hear Jews say, Roosevelt and Americans were anti-Semitic, you know, because they closed the borders to the Jews when Hitler came, you know, in the 30s.
Now, what and was Stephen Weiss, the famous rabbi, or infamous, if you want to consider it that way, the Zionist rabbi Stephen Weiss, was he trying to get as many Jews as possible out of the Hitler regime and to New York City?
No, and this fits in with Roosevelt. The fact, let me say before I get to that, the fact that I knew about Roosevelt that I just put on hold in the back of my mind. I couldn't figure it out because it was also a fact that that Roosevelt in the 30s closed off the United States to Jewish immigration. They didn't want any Jews coming here, the Roosevelt administration. Well, at first you'd say, gee, well,
in the 1930s, when the Hitler regime was coming to power and screaming bloody murder against the Jews, was the Roosevelt administration who would not allow Jews to come to New York. It was not Adolf Hitler who prevented their leaving Germany.
That's correct. So this shows that the bankers were having Roosevelt do his part and Hitler do his part by screaming bloody murder against the Jews, and England do their part and Stalin do their part. In other words, the way was closed as good as they could do it. I mean, some people with money were able to buy their way into the U.S., but the point is for the average person who didn't have a lot of resources, the way was closed to come to the United States and other places as much as they could have happened. And so then this left them the road they were saying is, why don't you go to Palestine? Why don't you go to Palestine? So that fact about Roosevelt is a strong indicator to someone who might be listening to this and might be skeptical that this was a orchestrated plan by international Jewish bankers in many countries. And it was different pieces of the plan were being implemented in different areas. So so at any rate, now when I knew one lady who was in Germany throughout this period and after World War II, I think she's still alive, but she might be in her 80s now. And she said to us when we talked to her about this a little, she said she was a young girl at the time and maybe in her early teens, but she said, we knew in the late 30s, we knew that the Jews were being rounded up, but we did not know why. That's the first thing. So we knew that. We saw that they were being rounded up. And she said, and of course, you know, they didn't do anything, but Americans don't do anything to stop a lot of injustice now. You know, most people do not generally run into the power that be and let themselves get shot up and killed, even if they know injustice is going around them. So the other thing she said, which was interesting, she said, I lived in Germany under Hitler, and I lived in East Germany under the communists, and it both felt the same. And she said, this is 1990s under Clinton, she says, and it's beginning to feel the same way here in the United States under Clinton. So she was recognizing that the Jewish power, Rothschild Zionist power, behind Hitler, behind the East German communists, and behind the current government we're getting in the United States that still hasn't succeeded in imposing a tyranny on the United States, she's feeling the same spirit coming out of all three, which is... Now, going back to the...
By that, you mean the control of the media, the...
The
militarism, the paranoia, the...
Yes.
Controlled
the
press.
Controlled news, yeah, the controlled news, the censoring of a lot of news that the average person isn't noticing, but someone like her might be noticing because they're reading other periodicals. The fear that is being subtly trying to be implanted in the people to not oppose anything that the government or the ruling elite is doing, all that kind of stuff. So
the two-party system, which is actually a totalitarian single-party system?
Yes, 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 exactly. And under Clinton, they really were coming out of the closet to show their hand. Now, so this is all happening in 33, and again, remember, the New York Times did not object in any significant way. I don't even think they objected in any way.
To the IBM punch cards.
No, or to Thomas Watson was traveling back and forth, and through the 30s, he got many public honors from Hitler that were publicized. And as far as I know, there wasn't even one article written. Now, you know, in New York City, the Zionist capital of the world, where almost everything is Jewish controlled, you know that if they objected, they could have started a jihad, if you'll forgive the use of the word, against IBM and against Thomas Watson. But no, Watson was doing what they wanted him to do, which was catalog these Jews over there in Germany and get them ready to be rounded up and so forth. Now,
I was actually in Germany, and I think there was an IBM building on the same corner where a synagogue once stood. But that's,
is that right?
Yes, that's neither here nor there.
So now let me mention one other thing, then we'll get to the transfer agreement and the Untermeyer speech. We have a pamphlet from the 1940s, which is, excuse me, from 1940, which is written by a Swede and a Brit. And that pamphlet is called Hitler's Policy is a Jewish Policy. It was written by, the names escape me right now, I hold it up on the DVD. And this was one that my mentor found, and it was just like a pamphlet like you or I or some normal person would put out now who doesn't have a lot of money. But they said in 1940, and this is take it or leave it, it was an eyewitness report, very well written, and I think by some very sharp guys, who said, we believe that Hitler is the most potent agent for world Jewry now on the world stage, and that his anti-Semitism is just a blind to throw people off, or a diversion to throw people off. And he said, for one of the points they made, and the whole pamphlet's worth reading, but one of the points they made was Hitler was the first leader in history to transfer Jewish racial laws onto Gentile soil, or in this case, German soil, the Nuremberg laws, which forbid to do the racial marriage laws and all that, on German soil, allegedly coming from a German soil.
Now, in Jewish law, in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, it specifically states that Jews are forbidden to marry non-Jews, and that mm-hmm. Jews have to maintain their racial purity, or else they are violating the laws of God and polluting God's chosen people. And Julius Streicher, at the Nuremberg trials, stated that the Nuremberg laws were based upon those Jewish laws.
And he did?
Yes. And the Jews in the Zionist press welcomed those laws and embraced them and thanked Hitler for enacting them and said that they had been calling for those laws for decades.
Well, if we ever get around to doing the finished version of a DVD, we're going to have to get together, and you're going to have to be on it because you know so many useful facts that fit into this whole thesis, you know. Now, of course, I also say if anybody can beat us to it, then do it. We just put this video out so people would not have to rediscover all these sources again, not have to start from scratch. Now, getting back now to your question about Untermeyer, Samuel Untermeyer gave a speech in 1933, I think, when Hitler came to power. And he basically said, we need to boycott all German goods. Now, this has been often cited by, I think, a lot of people who are sincere, and some neo-Nazi types who maybe knew a little more, that this is why Hitler didn't really declare war on the Jews. The Jews declared war on Hitler. So Hitler was a great guy, blah, 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 blah. That was what the spin that was given this. And this is a very well-publicized speech by Samuel Untermeyer, boycott German goods. I believe that Untermeyer, like Rabbi Stephen Wise, who you referred to earlier, these guys were also, I believe, part of a big-time wrestling act. You can have different disagreements. Maybe they disagreed with each other and the other factions to some extent. But I believe all the Untermeyer speech did was set it up so Hitler could use it as an excuse to the Germans in his command that we have to do the transfer agreement. This boycott against us, we can get goods into the countries that are boycotting us through the transfer agreement. And what it basically, the transfer agreement.
If I may interject, the Zionist Jews in Germany had been screaming since the 20s that they were a foreign, hostile nation within Germany. So your thesis, it is certainly true that this gave the Germans the opportunity to, this gave the Zionist Nazis the opportunity to tell the German people that we have a foreign enemy which is hostile to us on our soil and we have to get them out, which is exactly what the Zionist bankers wanted the German people to do.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the famous Zionist Theodor Herzl had always promised that those nations which expelled the Jewish people would profit from it.
Ah.
And the Zionists had always tried to establish means by which Gentile peoples could profit from persecuting and expelling the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Gentile peoples had the bad experience in Russia that after the assassination of Tsar Alexander, when the Jews were forced out, that the economy was badly hurt by the loss of investment capital and by the loss of workers.
And that would have been around 1860?
1880s, early 1880s.
1880s, okay.
That's when the big emigration of Russian Jews to America started and really built up in the 1890s through the 1920s. And that's
okay.
How the shift came in America from German Jews to Russian Jewish Zionists who gained control, and that's how they were able to get Wilson in.
I see.
But the point is...
And actually, this faction, the Russian Jews, are actually the ones that are now taking over the country through people like William Kristol, Paul Wolfowitz, etc.
Absolutely.
Taking over the United States right now.
And the German Jews hated them. The German Jews very much resented them and feared that the Ostjuden would promote anti-Semitism in America.
Mm-hmm.
So the relevant point is that this gave Hitler the opportunity to do for the Zionists what the Zionists wanted done. And it was also, Hitler needed the opportunity to begin a war to invade Poland, where many, many Jews resided, and also to invade Russia, the mm-hmm. Ukraine, Lithuania, and other nations where there were large pools of Jews who could be sent, forced to Palestine, but only if Hitler were able to occupy the territories where they lived. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's one of the most important points of the night. Getting to the Untermyer speech. So Untermyer gives this speech. Well, then what happened was Germany, in effect, under Hitler, they made a deal with the Zionists in Palestine. Remember now, Palestine was still Palestine then in the 1930s and so forth. And they made a deal that says, well, these countries that are boycotting us, or maybe even some that aren't, we'll let you be the middleman for our German manufacturing, and we'll send the goods through you to these countries, or send them to these countries for you. I'm not sure exactly how it all worked. And then the Jews in Palestine, that's top Zionists, would collect the difference. So maybe they collected 20% or 30% or 10% of the price, on the excuse that they could get goods into countries that were now boycotting Germany. And so this helped the Zionists in Palestine build up a war chest for the eventual takeover of Palestine, which happened in 1948, 3 years after the ending of World War II.
And it also promoted the German economy at a time when there was supposedly an international boycott of German goods.
Exactly. So I'm not so sure that the Untermyer speech wasn't one part of this. I have challenged the Hitler worshippers, as I call them. There's a certain amount of people, often with no religion, they want to keep this myth that Hitler was a great man, you know, and he was a great person. And so I've challenged them, can you find me one speech, one public utterance from Hitler or the Nazis complaining to the German people about the transfer agreement? Maybe there is such a thing. But my suggestion is that this was so unknown, even years after World War II, till Edwin Black, who is a Jewish author, wrote this book about the transfer agreement. At least that's where I think it became widely known. And I believe Hitler never complained, even though he was complaining about, you know, the anti-Semitism, screaming anti-Semitism on a lot of fronts. He did not mention this thing about the transfer agreement to the German people because it was a deal he was fulfilling, and it really is something that would start possibly to raise a ton of questions in a lot of people's minds. I know that there was a group of German generals who came to him in 1938, and I think this is again in Klaus Polkin's article, Secret Contacts Between Nazis and Zionists, 1933-1941, and they asked him to stop the transfer agreement, and Hitler overruled them and said, no, we'll keep it going. So these are some of the interesting facts that don't fit either. There's two popular myths that have been pushed in history, official history books about Hitler. One is that he's the cartoon character, satanic, dripping pure evil who wanted to kill every Jew in the world. The other is that among the neo-Nazis and others, that he's this pure German patriot who was just like the most noble guy that ever lived. And both of these are just absolutely blown to smithereens when you start looking at all of these facts. There's a book out called Hitler's Third Race, which is called, it's a book about the Mischlinge. And I'll see if I can get the exact title and the author here. And that book, which came out in, I believe, the 60s or 70s, talked about all of the half-Jews that Hitler declared Aryans. And this guy at the end of the book, which was another Jewish author, said, gee, if it wasn't for all the exceptions that Hitler made, then how many Jews would be left? You know, he didn't seem to exactly know what was going on.
Can you discuss, please, the Mark Brian Riggs book, Hitler's Jewish Soldiers?
Yes, that was published sometime in the 90s, I believe, and this was a book that was, you can look it up on the internet, anyone can. It's called Hitler's Jewish Soldiers by